Go ahead.
Yes, this issue is that inequity accounting, how a gain from a downstream transaction should be eliminated when the amount of the gain exceeds the amount of the investment account in the joint venture. This issue was discussed in the March Interpretation Committee meeting, and it was agreed that the gain should be eliminated even if the entity's share of the gain exceeds the carrying amount of the investment account. In the March meeting, it was also discussed about how to account for the corresponding entry for the eliminated gain in excess of the investment account. And three methods were discussed in that meeting. And as you can see in the page 7 of the paper, there are three methods. First method, method 1, is to present as a deferred gain. And method 2A is to reduce the related asset. But if the related asset is cash or cash equivalent, recognize the eliminated gain in profit or loss. And method 2B is to reduce the related asset. But if the related asset is cash or cash equivalents, recognize the eliminated gain as a deferred gain. So our first analysis is to think about method 2A and method 2B. The question to be addressed is whether the accounting can vary depending on the type of the asset the entity receives. And we came up with two approaches embedded in IAS 28. And we think that whether method 2A and 2B is justified depends on which approach we take. If we take the what we call consolidation procedure approach, these two methods are justified. However, if we take the contribution of non-monetary asset approach, they cannot be justified. And in our opinion, we think that the consolidation procedure approach should be applied to our case rather than contribution of non-monetary asset approach. This is because contribution of non-monetary asset approach is set out only for the specific case of the contribution of a non-monetary asset to a joint venture in exchange for an equity interest in the joint venture. Consequently, method 2A and method 2B would not be appropriate. So our next analysis is that the question is whether method 1, that is presenting as a deferred gain, is appropriate. So if we first look at IAS 28, when it says about contribution of a non-monetary asset to a joint venture, it states that deferred gains or losses should not be presented for the eliminated gains or losses if the contribution lacks commercial substance. But we don't think this means that a deferred gain should not be used in our case, because this requirement only relates to the circumstance of a contribution of a non-monetary asset to a joint venture in which the transaction lacks commercial substance. But our case is a transaction that has commercial substance. And in addition, when you look at other standards, presenting as a deferred gain is not prohibited. So we think that method 1 is the appropriate method. And our next analysis was that should we take this issue onto the agenda? We don't think this issue should not be taken onto the agenda because IAS 28 does not provide a general guidance on how an entity should account for the corresponding entry for the eliminated gain or loss arising from either upstream or downstream transactions. So if we were to provide guidance on this very specific issue, we need to address more general guidance on presentation for downstream and upstream transactions. And since more general guidance would be require a broader project on equity accounting, we think that such a project should be undertaken by the IASB rather than Interpretation Committee. And at the last, I want to mention some readers' further comment, because this issue was not discussed in March meeting, although it was included in the agenda paper. The submitter's further comment was whether a lease transaction between an entity and its joint venture can qualify as a finance lease. For example, if an entity has a 50% ownership interest in the joint venture, the submitter questions whether the criteria for the classification of a finance lease can be met. And our analysis is that the classification of a finance lease would not be dependent on whether the lease transaction is done between unrelated separate entities or between a joint venture and joint venture, just as revenue recognition is not affected when we look at the requirement for elimination of gains or losses from downstream or upstream transactions. So we do not recommend taking this issue onto the agenda either.
Comments? I'm going to work this way again, starting with Andrew.
I was basically fine with the staff's analysis and the direction of the agenda decision. I did have three comments on the agenda decision. One, I thought in the first paragraph we ought to make it clear that we're talking about a downstream transaction because that's what the submitter talked about. Secondly, we say in sort of two-thirds of the way down the first page, the interpretation committee also noted that presenting the eliminated gain in excess of the carrying amount would be appropriate. I'm fine with that. I just wondered whether we should give some justification to that statement. And secondly, thirdly, the next paragraph is interesting, but about the issue relating to a lack of guidance rather than conflict of guidance is kind of interesting, but wasn't sure why it was really necessary.
Okay. Florence?
You will recall that first I was not in agreement with the committee's first conclusion, or the last time conclusion, that you should eliminate the gain in full. But still, well, starting from your starting point that it should be eliminated in full, I do not favor method one. I prefer method two because I do consider that this cash that has gone up to the venture is similar to dividend distribution. The cash is in, the cash is there. So if it relates to assets that is cash, I don't see why you should defer that gain when the cash is in. If it had been a dividend distribution, you would have recognized the profit immediately. So I disagree with that. And picking up on Andrew's point, his second point about the draft rejection, again, when he says the interpretation committee also noted that presenting the eliminated gain in excess of the carrying amount of the entity's interest in a joint venture as a deferred gain would be appropriate based on what? And when I read in paragraph 51 that it's based because IAS 20 allows a deferred gain, I find the reason a little bit weak.
It's hard to write an agenda decision that says this is the least ugly or the least ugly solution that we can find. But Sandy?
My question was, if we followed method one and we used the deferred gain, when does it go away? Like, when do you recognize it? At the end or over time? Or did I miss that? Or
as in this paper, if we base our conclusion on the consolidation procedure approach, and if we think about consolidation procedures, when the asset is used or when that is sold to other unrelated parties, that gain should be recognized in your loss.
So over time, so as the asset is either consumed or used,
okay,
e.g. depreciated by the associates, so you would recognize that unrecognized gain over that period. Even if it's cash.
Does it disappear?
Exactly the same, because we're talking about the asset that's being sold, not what you got back in return.
Yeah.
Anything else, Sandy?
I think it is land.
It would be
one
sold.
Yeah. Anything else, Sandy?
No.
John?
Well, accepting the view that the gain is eliminated in full, which I think is debatable, but I think that method one is correct. I think it's. I don't think that the recognition depends upon the asset received, and I don't agree with changing the measurement of the asset that's been received as consideration. So I think the gain is presented as a deferred gain. Having said that, I think there is a view that it should only be recognized to the extent of the investment. But if it's not, if you take the full elimination view, I think it should be a deferred gain. So I agree with the staff position.
Yeah, I think for the benefit of the chairman and others who are listening, I find it difficult when we talk about, well, I'm a method one or a method two person. Maybe we can be a little more expansive in describing them. Scott?
Right, so now I have to be more expensive. I agree with the staff paper reluctantly. I think we have to eliminate the gain because I think that's what the standard says. And the staff paper has pretty well convinced me that there's nowhere else to put it other than deferred gain in certain situations. So by process of elimination, that's the only place I can find to put it. So I agree with the recommendation in general. I actually thought the tentative agenda decision was interesting because we say we know the answer, but we can't do anything with the standard to make that answer clear. So we're just going to leave it in the agenda decision. I would have thought we could add a sentence to IAS 28 without reopening anything else, because we thought we could answer this. We thought we could come up with the answer without, you know, despite the, quote, lack of guidance. So seems like we could drop that answer into the standard. But if opening IAS 28 is too scary, I can understand leaving it in an agenda decision. It just kind of felt like we were underselling our ability to get this answer into the standard.
Joanna, did you want to come in on this one?
Yes, please. I fundamentally disagree with where we have got to. And I'm afraid I'm actually going to go back to the first premise on which the staff paper is written, which is that we have to eliminate the whole profit. I actually question and am convinced that actually we don't have to eliminate any profit whatsoever, in that this is not a consolidation. The reason that it is eliminated from a consolidation, so using the terminology that's been used around the consolidation method, is because not only have you got an unrecognized profit in the group, you have an asset that effectively is uplifted, so you've got an unrealized gain on an asset. If you read paragraph 28 carefully, the first part of paragraph 28 actually says, so the first sentence says, the gains and losses from upstream and downstream, admittedly, are recognized only to the extent of unrelated investors' interest in the associate or joint venture. So that in the associate or joint venture, it talks nothing about the profit in the parent company or in the investor. And likewise, the last sentence in paragraph 28 says, the investor's share in the associate's or joint venture's gain or losses resulting from these transactions is eliminated. The investor's share in the associate's or joint venture's gains or losses, not the investor's gains or loss. And if you actually think about then what paragraph 30 says, 30 says basically the only time that you actually have an unrealized profit is when it lacks commercial substance. If you read 30 carefully, we're all hung up on what most people do, but actually I think paragraph 28, 30 and 31 all hang together incredibly well, are all completely consistent with each other, and actually say we do not eliminate any profit whatsoever on a downstream sale from an investor to an associate. We are not doing a consolidation. So I think that that's partly, if you like, why we've got this dilemma with what the hell we do with it, is because actually we're trying to do the wrong thing with it in the first place. Because, I mean, I 100% agree, even if you don't agree with my arguments here, that it, to use IS-20 as the reason for saying it should be a deferred gain, I find unbelievable. So that's my view, that basically I think the earning process is complete between an investor and associate, and we should not be eliminating it whatsoever. It's absolutely consistent with the when we actually give an asset as part of, so with paragraph 31, in terms of the entity recognizes in full, in profit or loss, a portion of the gain relating to the monetary or non-monetary assets received. Why is it any different? At that, I'll leave it.
Okay. Laurence, and then I'm going to try and phrase a question.
Yes, it was picking up on Scott's point about whether we should modify S28 or not. Currently, there is diversity in practice here. I don't think that the answer is so clear that the gain or loss should be eliminated in full. So I do not believe that using an agenda rejection with saying this is the treatment, this is how it should be treated, is a proper way to address this issue.
Okay. I thought I had two questions, now I have three. At the last meeting, I believe Joanna did make her point that she didn't think the elimination was necessary. I don't recall any others agreeing with that. Do I hear any agreement with her point now?
Is she saying that you would never recognize or never eliminate the gain or loss?
I'll let her speak for herself, but that was what I heard her say.
Then why would you need 28 at all?
Joanna, do you want to try and speak to that?
Yeah, if you actually read 28, but upstream, absolutely you need 28. And it's actually, if you remove the word upstream and downstream and just read that, it could only be to upstream. I actually think where the issue is that the word downstream appears in 28 as a single word, but actually you read the context of paragraph 28, and as I said, that very last sentence again, all you are eliminating is the gains or losses in the associate or joint venture. In a downstream transaction, there is no gain or loss. Therefore, there is no elimination. So, yes, Sandy, I'm saying there is, in a downstream transaction from an investor to an associate, there should be no elimination. IS 28 and paragraph 28 does not require an elimination as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. We're going to finish this by 1 o'clock. So, Laurence, did you want to come back in? No. Charlotte.
I'm just trying to think about what Joanne says. I think there are two things in 28. There are gains and losses that the investor recognises or would see in its own financial statements, which are eliminated. Then there are gains and losses which come from it picking up its share of the associate's P&L. And I think they're two different things. I think Joanne's still saying that the latter bit informs what you do on the first, which doesn't make sense to me.
But where does it say you actually eliminate it from the investor statement?
It says they're recognising the financial statements only to the extent of the unrelated investor's interests.
Right, so you're reading the sentence differently.
Hey, wait. Microphone discipline here.
Sorry. Because I think the question becomes is how you read unrelated investors' interests in the associate or joint venture. That interest comes in two ways, right? Isn't that what Charlotte is saying?
No. I would say that sentence just says if you've got somebody else who's got a combination of people who say you've got 70% of the associate, you can recognise 70% of the P&L. You always eliminate your share. But then you've got the bit you pick, the equity pickup amount, where you lose if the associate's made a profit, that's eliminated.
Right, but there's one sentence. Agreed, but this one sentence is confusing which one you're referring to.
Yeah. Right?
Point taken, but I think we've beaten this one as much as we can.
So I will vote against this, but that is fine if no one else agrees with me.
Okay. Now, I heard John speak, and maybe Laurence, to the view that we should not eliminate 100%. That we should only eliminate, I assume, John, to the level of till it reduces the investment to zero. Is that correct?
And I thought it was acceptable interpretation of 28 that you could get there. But I can understand the other view as well. But it seems to me that if we take that other view, it should be done not just through a rejection. So.
Okay, that's going to be the next question, Andrew.
So I just wanted to point out that I thought we had this debate at the last committee and we agreed that the gain should be eliminated in full.
No, I'd heard a couple of people say, well, I really didn't agree with that, so I just wanted to circle back and make sure that people's views hadn't fundamentally changed. Laurence?
I had expressed that view at the last meeting, so okay. I'm not coming back on that. I'm just now saying that I disagree that it should be treated in an agenda rejection.
The majority view of the committee,
for me, should not be dealt with in an agenda rejection.
Okay. Now, that leads to the third question, which is whether we do it in an agenda rejection, say that five times quickly, or whether, as Scott, Laurence, and maybe others have said, we need to look at what language needs to be added to 28. And so that's a kind of a binary decision. I assume if we amended 28, we would also have to introduce in the debit as a deferred gain. You'd have to do both parts. How many would favor asking the board to amend 28?
I'm sorry, can you say it again?
How many would favor, first choice, asking the board to amend 28?
Nine.
That carries. All right, we will look at amending language and take that forward to the board. I think the decision is sufficiently clear that we don't need to bring back to you. Joanna, I assume you're going to vote no on that one, given your previous view.
Yeah, I mean, if we're doing something this way, I believe it should be in the standard rather than in a tentative agenda decision, but I will still vote no.
No amendment.
Because I disagree.
Okay. So these are two people who would say, I hate the answer, but if you're going to do it, put it in the standard. Okay. I don't believe we need to bring that back to you before taking it to the board. But this may be the first test case of thinking about how we stage. Staging meaning the logistics of taking these things first to the board and then out to the constituents that I talked about earlier. So we'll have to think about that a little bit. But I think the committee's view is clear on how we should go. Okay. 10 minutes till 1. We'll reconvene at 2. We have to be on time because Liz Figge is adjoining us on video.